Much hung between them. Not quite blame, because neither of them were to blame for what had happened, but something close to it. Their pain, individual, radiated off them both like auras, pushing at each other like magnets with the poles reversed, forcing them apart. Charlie? John was saying her name and she looked over at him. Sorry, she said. I drifted for a second.
You got any music in this car?
He asked, and she nodded eagerly, seizing on the diversion. She bent over, picked up cassettes scattered on the floor, and started reading labels. He made fun of her tapes, she argued back, and after some playful bickering, she shoved a tape into the player and settled back again to stare out the window.
I think this is where the map's usefulness ends.
John gestured to the road ahead.
The whole area is pretty much blank. I think what we're looking for isn't going to be on this map.
He folded the map and tucked it neatly to the side of the seat, craning his neck out the window to see what they were passing.
Yeah, she said. It looked like they had returned to civilization.
Single houses littered the fields, and dirt roads branched off in all directions. The landscape was mostly bushes and short trees, the whole area nestled between rows of low-lying mountains. John looked at Charlie, hoping she would notice something that would point them in the right direction.
Nothing,
he said, though her blank stare had already given him the answer.
No,
she said plainly. She didn't want to elaborate. The houses became fewer and more scattered, and the fields of dry brush seemed to stretch wider, giving the whole area a feeling of desertion. John found himself glancing over at Charlie at short intervals, waiting for a signal, half expecting her to tell him to stop and turn around, but Charlie just stared into the distance, her eyes fixed on nothing, resting her cheek in her hand.
Let's go back, she said finally, sounding resigned.
We could have missed something, John said.
He slowed the car, looking for a spot to make a U-turn.
We missed a lot back there. Maybe it's down one of those dirt roads.
Charlie laughed. Really? You think we missed a lot? She grew thoughtful.
No, none of this feels right. Nothing rings a bell.
She felt a tear spill onto her cheek, and she swiped it away before John could notice.
Okay, no worries, Charlie said abruptly, pulling herself back from reverie. Let's grab a bite, just you and me.
John smiled, still checking his mirrors for a place to turn. Charlie shivered. Then something caught her eye. She almost jumped in her seat, sitting straight up.
Stop! She shouted.
John slammed on the brakes and the car skidded, dust billowing up all around the car. When they stopped, Charlie sat silently as John checked the rearview mirror again, his heart racing.
Are you okay? He said,
but Charlie was already out of the car.
Hey!
He called after her, scrambling out of his seatbelt and rushing to lock the car behind him. Charlie was running back toward the town, but her eyes were on the field beside the road. He caught up quickly, trotting along beside her without asking questions. After a few minutes, Charlie slowed and began shuffling her feet on the ground, peering down as though she had lost something small and valuable in the dirt.
Charlie? John said.
Until this moment, he had not thought about what it was they were doing. It was an adventure, a chance to be alone with Charlie, to run off after a clue, but now she was starting to worry him. He brushed his hair back from his face.
Charlie?
He said again, his voice touched with concern. But Charlie did not look at him. She was intent on whatever she had found.
Right here, she said.
She made a sharp turn toward the edge of the road, where something protruded and snaked across the ground. John knelt carefully, brushing some of the loose dirt with his hand and exposing a flat metal beam. He kept going, uncovering a track that stretched across the road and went off into the field in both directions. It took him a moment to speak. It was as though the earth itself had tried to conceal it from them.
Be careful, he thought with a minor pang of alarm, but he brushed aside the feeling.
I think we found your tracks, he said, looking up at Charlie, but she was nowhere in sight.
Charlie? He took a quick look up and down the road, but there were no cars.
Charlie, he called again, waving the dust away from his face and racing to catch up.
When he reached her, he hung back a little, afraid to disturb her intense focus. There was a cluster of trees up ahead, gathered together as though around a campfire, tall and short or thick and scraggly. Charlie dragged her foot along the track as she walked, as if it might vanish if she ceased to touch it.
What is that? An old station?
John asked, squinting and blocking the sun with his hand. There was a long building nestled in the trees, its color blending in with the small grove, making it difficult to spot. The tracks veered away, heading off toward the mountains, and Charlie stopped dragging her foot along them, letting them go. John finally caught up, and they walked through the dry grass together toward the grove of trees, not far away now.
There has to be a road.
Charlie strayed almost randomly, heading away from the building. John hesitated.
But...
He gestured toward the building, then followed her, looking back to make sure he knew the way back to the car. Before long, the ground leveled out beneath their feet. Old pavement, broken with weeds and mounds of crumbling rock, stretched across the field in a narrow, almost hidden path, leading once again toward the small building.
This is it, Charlie said softly.
John approached her carefully, then stood at her side. They walked the road together, dodging around the pillars of grass that shot up from the breaks and holes. The tree was there, the one with reaching arms and ghastly face, but it was no longer frightening, no longer as Charlie remembered. It must have already been dead when she was a child, she realized. Its limbs had fallen off, leaving jagged holes where they had been, and they lay where they fell, rotting into the ground. The tree seemed a frail and weak shade of its former self, only recognizable by the stumps and bulges on its side that had made its face. Now even the face looked tired. The building itself was long and dilapidated. It was a single story, with a dark roof and weather-beaten walls. The place had once been painted red, but time and sun and rain had won out over the paint. It was peeled and curling, whole long strips of it gone, and the wood beneath showing, dark with what might be rot. Its foundation was overgrown with tall grass, and Charlie thought it looked as if it were sinking, as though the whole structure was slowly being swallowed by the earth. Charlie grabbed John's arm as they neared it, then let it go and straightened her back. She felt as though she were preparing for a fight, as if the building itself might attack if it sensed weakness. Charlie went warily up the few steps to the door, sticking to the edges and testing the wood before she let down her full weight. The stairs held, but they were soft, splintered patches in the middle she didn't want to try. John didn't follow her right away, sidetracked by something nearly hidden in the grass.
Charlie.
He held it up, a battered metal sign with the painted words, Fred Bear's Family Diner, in red script. Charlie gave a gentle smile.
Of course this is it. I'm home.
John came up the stairs behind her and set the sign down carefully by the door, and they went inside. The door swung open easily. Light streamed in through the windows on all sides, revealing emptiness and decay. Unlike Freddy's, this place had been cleaned out. The wooden floors seemed intact, but they were warped from weather. Sunlight was streaming in, unobstructed, and went where it wanted without furniture or people to block its path. Charlie looked up at the ceiling fan. It was still there, but one of its blades was missing. There were double doors to their right with circular windows. Unlike the dining area, which was breached with sunlight and the sounds of the outside, the room behind the double doors was still pitch black. John was more interested in this than Charlie, and he carefully peered into one of the windows, obviously tempted to nudge it open and see what was inside. Charlie left him to his curiosity and walked farther into the dining room, which he only knew as the dining room through memory. Now it was a vacant and lonely room, stretching long and narrow, at least 50 feet, growing darker as it went. There was a slightly elevated stage at the end of the room, and Charlie realized as she looked around that the place had probably once been a dance hall, and the long desk by the entrance that her parents had used for a cash register had probably been a bar. She went over to it and saw that she was right. There were even grooves and scratches in the wood floor where bar stools had once dug their feet. She tried to picture it, a dark bar with a country western band playing on the stage, but she could not. When Charlie looked at the stage, she could still see two animatronic animals in shadow, moving in unnatural twists and turns. She could hear echoes of carnival music and distant laughter. She could still smell the cigarette smoke in the air. She hesitated before going farther, as though the ghosts she remembered might linger on the stage. She tried to catch a glimpse of where John was. He finally had the door to the kitchen half open and was sticking his head inside. Charlie turned her attention back to the stage and walked toward it across the creaking floor. Even the smallest sound was deafening, accompanied by faint whistles as the wind slipped through cracks in the windows and walls. Strips of wallpaper had peeled down and hung flat against the wall, inert until a breeze lifted them up, and they wagged like thin fingers pointing at Charlie as she walked. Charlie stood at the base of the stage, studying the floor carefully for traces of what might have stood there before. All that remained were holes where bolts had once been. The corners looked blackened, with the shapes of coils and wires etched into dirt and wood. Everything is gone. Her head jerked toward the corner to her right. There was another door. Of course there is another door. This is why you are here. She stood still, looking at the door, but not ready to touch it. She was grasped with a strange and illogical fear, as though spiders and boogeymen might come rushing out. The door was ajar. Charlie looked back toward John again, hesitant to go on without him. As though he heard her calling to him, he leaned out of the kitchen door with a wide-eyed expression.
This is really creepy.
He was obviously enjoying himself, like a kid in a haunted house. Can you come with me? Charlie's plea came as a surprise to John, who seemed pleased but irritated at the same time, having been enjoying his own adventure on the other side of the building.
2 seconds, he promised, then disappeared again.
She rolled her eyes, disappointed but not surprised that his childish curiosity would take priority. She rested the back of her hand against the aged wooden door and gently guided it open, bracing herself against whatever might be inside. Whatever she had been expecting, this wasn't it. It was a closet, the inside extending off to her left about 8 or 9 feet into darkness. There were horizontal poles mounted along the walls where hangers had once been. Square shapes imprinted in the dust filled her mind with images of boxes, maybe speakers. As she stepped inside, she pushed the door open all the way, trying to let in as much light as possible. As she walked farther in, she let her hand drag along the wall. Although nothing was there now, she could feel heavy cloth, coats and sweaters hanging. No, these were costumes. Costumes had hung here in the dark, hiding their colors but allowing themselves to be felt by every cheek and small hand that passed through. Rubber-padded palms and fingers swayed this way and that. Reflections on false eyes passed overhead. Charlie reached the end and turned to look back. She crouched down, looking up at the empty space. It didn't feel empty. She could still feel the costumes. They were hanging all around her. There was someone else in the closet with her, kneeling down at her own height. It was her friend, the little boy. My little brother. They were both playing and hiding together as they always did. This time was different. The little boy looked up toward the door suddenly, as though they had been caught doing something they shouldn't have been doing. Charlie looked up as well. There was a figure in the door. It looked like one of the costumes was standing on its own, but it was motionless, so still that Charlie wasn't sure what she was seeing. It was the rabbit, the yellowish-brown rabbit they loved, but it did not dance or sing, just stood there and stared at them, unblinking. They began to squirm under its gaze, and the little boy screwed up his face to wail. Charlie pinched his arm, seized with an instinctual sense that they must not cry. The rabbit looked back and forth from one to the other with those all-too-human eyes, ponderous, as though weighing and measuring them in some way that Charlie could not understand, like it was making a momentous decision. Charlie could see its eyes, its human eyes, and she was cold with terror. She felt the fear in her brother as well, felt it echoing between them, reverberating and growing because it was shared. They could not move. They could not scream. And finally, the creature inside that patchwork, ragged yellow rabbit suit reached forward for the boy. There was a moment, one single moment, when the children still clung together, gripping hands, but the rabbit snatched the boy to his breast, yanking them apart, and fled. From that moment, the entire memory shattered with piercing and unrelenting screams, not her brother's, but her own. People rushed to help. Her father picked her up and held her, but nothing could console her. She screamed and screamed, louder and louder. Charlie snapped back from her dream, the sound still high and painful in her ears. She was crouched down in silence. John stood at the door, not daring to interrupt. She did not remember much of what had happened next. Everything was dark. It was all a blur of images and facts she had pieced together later, things she might remember and others she might have imagined. She was never in the restaurant again. She knew her parents shuttered the doors immediately. Then they moved to the new house, and Charlie's mother left a little while after that. Charlie did not remember her saying goodbye, although she knew her mother must have. Her mother would not have left without a goodbye, but it was just lost in the mist of time and grief like so much else. She remembered the first time she stood in the doorway of her father's workshop, the first day they were alone in everything. It was the day he began to build her a mechanical toy, a little dog who tilted its head from side to side. She smiled when she saw it finished, and her father looked at her the way he would look at her for the rest of his life, as though he loved her more than life itself, and as though his love made him unbearably sad. She knew even then that something vital inside him had broken, something that could never be repaired. Sometimes he seemed to look right through her, as if he couldn't see her even when she was standing right in front of him. Her father never again spoke her brother's name, and so Charlie learned not to speak it either, as though to speak it would send them back to that time and unravel them both. She woke in the mornings and looked for the little boy, having forgotten in her dreams that he was gone. When she turned to where he would be and saw only her stuffed toys, she would cry, but she would not say his name. She was afraid to even think it, and she trained her mind to shrink from it until she truly forgot. But deep inside, she knew it. Sammy. A rumbling sound rose, loud and low like a train passing, and Charlie startled. A train? She looked around her, eyes wide. She was disoriented, not sure if she was in the past or present. It's okay. I don't think it's anywhere near here. Might just be a big truck. John took Charlie's arm and pulled her to her feet. Did you remember something? He whispered. He was trying to catch her gaze, but she was focused elsewhere. A lot. Charlie put her hand to her mouth, still staring into the darkness as if she could see the scene. John's hand on her arm was an anchor, and she clung fast to it.
This is real. This is now, she thought, and she turned to him, seized by a fierce gratitude that he was there with her.
She buried her face in his chest, as if his body could shield her from what she had seen, and she let herself cry. John hugged her tight, one hand on her head, cautiously stroking her hair. They stayed that way for long moments, and at last she calmed, her breathing deep and even again. John loosened his grip on her, and as soon as he did, Charlie stepped back, suddenly aware of how close they had been. John's hands were still suspended in midair from where Charlie had been. After a moment of shock, he lowered one and used the other to scratch his head.
So,
he hoped for an answer to fill the silence.
A rabbit, Charlie said calmly, looking toward the doorway. A yellow rabbit.
Her voice became graver as the image was still fresh in her mind.
The one I saw the night Michael disappeared. The bear. I'm pretty sure he was yellow too.
I thought you said it was like the others, Charlie said.
I thought it was. When everybody said Freddy was brown, that night we first met up, I just thought I was remembering it wrong. I mean, I really don't have a great memory for back then, you know? I didn't even remember what color my old house was. But then you said he was yellow, too.
Yeah, they were yellow. She nodded. It was the answer he was expecting.
I think it's connected. The animals from here, and the one I saw at Freddy's.
And the one that took my brother, Charlie thought. She took a final look around the place.
Let's go back, she said. I want to get out of here.
Okay, John said. As they headed to the door, a small object caught Charlie's eye and she snatched it up. It was a twisted piece of metal, and as John watched, close by, she stretched it out, then let it snap back together with a loud crack, like a whip. John jumped.
What is that?
He said, composing himself.
I'm not sure, she said, but she slipped it into her pocket.
John was watching her like there was something he wanted to say.
Let's go, Charlie said.
They began the trek back to the car.
Sammy, then years later Michael and the other kids. Of course it's connected, Charlie thought.
Lightning might strike twice, but not murder.
Can you drive again?
She asked after a long period of silence. The only sound so far had been their shoes crunching through the dry grass.
Yeah, of course, he said.
John managed to get the car turned around in the constricted space, and Charlie settled against the window, her eyes half closed already. She watched the trees fly by outside her window and felt herself beginning to doze. The metal object in her pocket was digging into her leg, keeping her awake, and she repositioned it, thinking dreamily of the first time she saw one of the things. She was sitting with Sammy in the restaurant before it opened for the day. They were under a window, in a dusty beam of light, playing some invented game she could no longer remember, and their father came over, grinning. He had something to show them. He held up the piece of twisted metal and showed them how it opened, then let it snap back in his hand. They both cried out in surprise, then started giggling and clapping their hands. Their father did it again.
I could snap off your nose, he said, and again they laughed,
but quickly his face turned serious.
I mean it, he said. This is a spring lock, and I want you to know how it works because it's very dangerous, and I don't ever want you touching these. This is why we never put our hands in the animal costumes. It's very easy to trigger these if you don't know what you're doing, and you could get hurt. It's like touching the stove. Do we ever touch the stove?
They shook their heads with a solemnity beyond their years.
Good, because I want you both to grow up with all your noses, he cried,
and he swept them up, one in each arm, swinging them around as they laughed. Suddenly there was a loud snap. Charlie jolted out of sleep.
What was that?
What was what?
John said. The car was off. Charlie looked around. They were back at the motel. Charlie took a moment to reorient herself, then gave a reluctant smile.
Thanks for driving.
What were you dreaming about?
John said.
You looked happy.
Charlie shook her head.
I don't remember.
Chapter 6. The other car was gone from the lot, and when they went into the room, there was a note on Charlie's pillow, written in Marla's big, loopy handwriting.
We're meeting for dinner at 6:30, and then going to you-know-where, she had written. See you too soon. Don't forget about the rest of us.
XOXO Marla. She had drawn a smiley face and a heart below her name. Charlie smiled to herself, folding the note and slipping it into her pocket without showing it to John.
What does it say?
He asked.
We have to meet them at the diner in, she checked her watch,
an hour. John nodded. He was still standing in the doorway, waiting for something.
What?
Charlie said.
I need to go change, he said, gesturing at the rumpled clothing he was wearing. Can I take your car?
He held up the keys and jangled them.
Oh, yeah, of course. Just come back for me,
Charlie said with a grin. He smiled.
Of course,
he added with a wink. When the door closed behind him, Charlie let out a sigh.
Alone at last.
She was unaccustomed to so much company. She and Aunt Jen moved in their own orbits, meeting gladly from time to time throughout the day, but with the assumption that Charlie could take care of her own needs or would speak up if she could not. Charlie never spoke up. She could feed herself, get to school and back, and maintain her high grades and casual friendships. What could Aunt Jen do about nightmares? About questions she did not really want the answers to? What could Aunt Jen tell her that was not even more horrific than what she already knew? So she was not used to the sustained presence of other people, and it was a little tiring. She showered quickly and pulled on new clothes, jeans and a black t-shirt, then lay back on the bed, staring up at the ceiling. She had a vague sense that her mind should be racing with excitement or horror at their discoveries, going over and over the memories she had awakened, searching for something new. Instead, she just felt blank. She wanted to be alone, to push the memories to the back of her mind where they belonged. After what seemed like only a few short minutes, there was a knock on the door, and Charlie sat up, checking her watch. More time had passed than she realized. It was time to leave. She let John in.
I have to put on my shoes, she said.
She looked up at him as she knotted the laces. He had changed, this time into jeans and a t-shirt, a contrast with the formal clothes she had gotten used to. His hair was still wet, and there was something fresh and bright about him. She smiled a little.
What?
He said when he noticed.
Nothing, she said.
You still look dirty, she joked as she pushed past him. They got in the car. This time she drove, and when they reached the diner, Charlie turned off the engine and hesitated, not moving to leave the car.
John, she said, I don't want to tell anyone about Fredbear's.
But,
he stopped himself.
Yeah, he said. I think we forget this is your life and not just some adventure. It's fine. I can keep a secret.
It's all our lives, she said. We were all there. We can tell them later. I just want to sort some of it out for myself right now.
You got it,
he said, and he looked a little pleased. Charlie knew why. It was a secret between them, something she entrusted only to him. When they went inside, everyone was already halfway through dinner. Charlie realized with a sharp pang that she had not eaten all day, and she found herself suddenly starving. The waitress spotted them as they sat down and came over immediately. They talked intermittently, Lamar, Jason, and Marla had gone to a movie, and Carlton and Jessica had played video games at his house. But their conversation was cursory, just filling the time as they ate. Charlie barely listened, and she had the feeling that even those who were talking were paying little attention to their own words. There was an agitated energy among the group. They were all just waiting, their minds already focused on Freddy's.
"What about you two?" Jessica asked, looking at Charlie and John.
"Yeah, what about you two?" Marla echoed with a twinkle in her eye.
"We just went for a drive," John said quickly. "Got lost for a while."
"I bet you did," Carlton muttered into his burger, grinning slyly even though his mouth was full. After dinner, the group hurried through the mall and toward the restaurant, hushed and cautious. As they passed through the atrium, their shoes made only soft sounds on the tiled floor, and no one spoke. Charlie had left the big flashlight in the car. They knew their way well enough by now, and the guard had almost seen them the night before. There was no reason to risk drawing extra attention. They came to the end of the hall, and Lamar, at the front of the group, stopped short. Charlie bumped into Marla before she realized what was happening, and she murmured an apology, then froze. The night guard was blocking the alley behind Freddy's, his arms folded across his chest. He had no flashlight, and so he had been invisible, hidden in the darkness until they were almost upon him.
"I had a feeling you wouldn't leave it alone," he said with an odd, uneven smile.
Marla whispered something unpleasant under her breath.
"I could have you arrested for trespassing," he said. "Saw you here last night, but I couldn't see where you got to. I guess now I know," he added with a smirk.
There was something almost immediately off-putting about the man. He was tall and slightly too thin for his uniform, which bagged at the shoulders and waist, as if he had once been a more robust man but had lost his form somehow to illness or tragedy. His name tag, reading Dave, hung askew on his chest. His skin was sallow, and his eyes were undercut by heavy lines, adding to the impression of long-standing ill health.
"What were you all doing back here anyway?" he demanded. "You kids partying? Drugs? I could have you arrested right now, you know."
Charlie and John glanced at each other.
"We're sorry," Lamar said quickly. "We'll go. We don't have any drugs."
"Says who? Says you?"
The guard wore an odd expression, and his words were harsh and fast. He seemed not to be responding to what they were saying. He looked angry, but his mouth kept quirking up at the corners, like he was trying not to smile.
"What do we do?" Jessica whispered.
"Probably the most action he's ever had out here," Carlton said with a hint of disdain, and Charlie remembered suddenly that Carlton's father was a cop.
She remembered him in his uniform, tilting down his dark sunglasses at them with a mock glare, then smiling, revealing the joke. The guard, however, looked like he meant it.
"We'll go," Lamar said again. "Sorry."
Charlie looked at the man, considering him. The ill-fitting uniform, his peaky, almost exhausted-looking features. He really could kick them off the property or even have them arrested for trespassing, but still, she could not really fear him. His inadequacy shone through him like a kind of negative charisma. He would always be shoved to the back of a crowd, always shouted down in an argument, always picked last, forgotten, ignored in favor of those who were simply more vital, more vigorously attached to life. Charlie frowned at herself. It was an unusual train of thought for her. She did not usually assume she could read the lives of strangers through the lines on their faces. But it gave her an idea.
"Why don't you come with us?" she said. "We just want to explore a little bit more. Then we'll leave. You know your way around better than any of us," she added, hoping that some of the flattery would stick.
"And then we'll never come back again," Carlton said.
The guard did not immediately dismiss the idea, and the others quickly chimed in with their own assurances. The guard peered at them one by one, fixing his gaze on each in turn. When he looked at Charlie, she looked away, not wanting to meet his eyes, as if she would be giving something away if she let him look too deeply. Once he had inspected them to his satisfaction, he nodded.
"Sure," he said. "Only because I've always wanted to take a walk in there myself."
He jerked a thumb behind him, and, catching the surprise that must have shown on their faces, added,
"I'm not an idiot. I've been working here for years, walked this building inside and out every night. You think I don't know what's back there?"
Charlie felt herself flush. She had somehow assumed their discovery was unique. The guard looked down at his name tag suddenly, then pointed to it.
"Name's Dave," he said.
"I'm Jason," Jason said, and, a little warily, the others recited their own names in turn. They stood there, looking at one another awkwardly for a moment, no one wanting to be the first to move. Then Jessica shrugged.
"Come on," she said.
She walked quickly to the scaffolding that hid the alley to Freddy's and pulled back the plastic, revealing the break in the wall, and they all filed through, squeezing past the piled boxes. Dave hung back politely, letting them all go first. He motioned to Charlie to go ahead.
"I don't want you behind me," Charlie thought.
She looked at Jessica, who wasn't moving either.
"Please, go ahead," Charlie said with an edge in her voice, and Dave ducked his head shyly and went.
Charlie followed him, and Jessica tucked the plastic carefully back where it was, concealing their passing even though there was no one left to catch them. As they made their way down the dank alley, Charlie touched her fingers to the brick wall, dragging her hand along it as if to guide her. The flashlight seemed a little dimmer now, though she knew it could only be her imagination. They led the guard to the heavy wooden shelf that hid the entrance, and Lamar, John, and Jessica dragged it out of the way, revealing the door. Charlie expected their new companion to be impressed, but he just nodded, as if he had suspected this all along. One by one, they entered the hall to the restaurant, and again Charlie lagged back from the group. She caught Carlton by the arm as he passed her.
"Carlton," she whispered. "Have you ever seen this guy?"
Carlton shook his head.
"It's not that small a town. I don't know everybody."
Charlie nodded absently, her eyes still on the newcomer as they made their way down the long hallway into Freddy's main dining room. She had invited the guard because it seemed like the only way to get back in, but now she was beginning to regret it. Letting a stranger into Freddy's was like letting him into her home, like giving something up.
"What happened to the restaurant?"
Lamar said, his tone carefully even, forcing a friendliness he could not have felt.
"Why is it boarded up? And why is the mall abandoned anyway?"
His voice sounded thin in the narrow hallway, a little muted.
"You don't know?" Dave said. "This town needs money, jobs, revenue, things like that. And one thing we've got a lot of is space. So they decided to build a big mall, try and attract businesses, maybe even tourists. They built up around where Freddy Fazbear's was, but when it came to it, no one would lease the restaurant, you know, because of what happened. So someone had the bright idea of sealing the whole place up, intact. Someone who had a sentimental attachment to it, perhaps. I don't think they even tried to clear it out. But it wasn't enough. Something about that place spilled over into the rest of the building, maybe right down into the soil. No one wanted to bring their business here. Sometimes business owners, franchisers from outside the town, would come and look at the place, but they never signed the papers. Said it just didn't feel right. I think it's got an aura, a mystical energy maybe, if you believe in that sort of thing."
Dave wiggled his fingers in the air as though casting a spell.
I don't believe in that sort of thing, Lamar said shortly, but the guard did not seem to notice his tone.
To each his own, he said. All I know is no one ever wanted their stores here, and they abandoned the construction before the building was even finished. Now nobody comes up here except kids wanting to screw around. And me, he added with what sounded like pride.
He must have felt possessive, Charlie thought. The only one who ever came here for years and years. It must have felt like it belonged to him, this strange, half-finished building. To him, they must be the invaders. They came to the end of the hallway, and the space opened up before them. Jessica ran ahead to the control room beneath the stage, her flashlight bobbing merrily ahead of her. She disappeared for a moment, then hit the light switch, and all at once the room was warm and bright. Charlie stopped, blinking in the sudden light. Dave brushed past her, and as he did, something caught her eye. There was a scar on his neck, curved and ugly, almost a perfect half-moon. The tissue was knotted and white. The cut that made it must have been a deep one. Only a few feet away, Dave turned in a circle, taking in the restaurant, awed. And as he did, Charlie saw that the scar had a twin, the same half-moon, in the same place on the other side of his neck. She shivered a little. The marks were too clean, too perfectly placed. They almost looked deliberate. The group fanned out. Carlton, for some reason, headed toward the kitchen, and Jason wandered away toward the arcade again.
Be careful, Marla called after him, but she was already following Lamar to the control room to join Jessica.
Charlie hung back, and John stayed with her. There was something different in the air, Charlie thought. It felt thinner, like she had to breathe deeper to get enough oxygen. It's just a guy, she told herself. But that was the problem. They had brought an outsider in with them, and now the restaurant felt less secure, no longer hidden away. Freddy's had been breached. Freddy, Bonnie, and Chica had begun to jerk in their stiff, single movements. Charlie looked at Dave, but he did not appear surprised. He's been here before, she thought. Then, of course he's been here before. The whole town used to come here back then. John motioned her on, and reluctantly she went with him to the control room, Dave tagging along behind them like a stray. In the booth, Jessica was hunched over, pressing buttons, and Lamar was studying the control board, trying to make sense of it. Dave peered intently over their shoulders, watching. He was nodding slightly to himself, wrapped up in some private calculation, and when Jessica stepped back and stretched, he cleared his throat. He said.
Could I try?
He drew himself up a little, extending his arm graciously. Jessica and Lamar exchanged glances, then shrugged.
Why not? Jessica said.
They shuffled around so that he could reach the board, and he stared down at it for a long moment without moving, then touched a short series of buttons. A hum rose from the speakers, a long, low tone that did not waver.
Whoa,
Jessica said and pointed to the monitors. Charlie saw movement on the screen and backed out of the control room to look for herself. On stage, the animals were dancing. Crudely, awkwardly, without the grace or complexity Charlie remembered, but they were moving in sequences, not just one motion at a time. Charlie went back to the control room but did not go beyond the door.
How did you do that?
She snapped, not caring if it was rude. Dave raised his hands in the air.
Beginner's luck, he said. I just pressed some buttons.
Right, Charlie said. She rubbed her temples. Can someone please turn off the speakers?
Lamar darted forward and flipped a switch, and the sound died. Despite the silence, Charlie felt as if she could still hear it, whining away inside her head. She closed her eyes for a moment, and when she opened them, Jessica and Lamar had gone back to working the controls, but there was a caution to their movements, and they glanced at each other every few seconds as if seeking reassurance. Charlie looked at John. His arms were folded across his chest, and his eyes were trained on the back of Dave's head. In the arcade, Carlton pressed some random buttons on a game console, knowing nothing would happen, then turned around, finding himself the subject of an 11-year-old's resentful stare.
"What?"
he said.
"I'm not a baby," Jason said. "You don't have to watch me."
"What?"
"Jason, I'm not watching you. I'm just hanging out with you. I'm not Marla. Go stick your tongue in an electric socket for all I care."
He waggled his eyebrows comically, and Jason laughed.
"Okay, then, maybe I will," he said.
He scanned the baseboards for a socket, briefly considering calling Carlton's bluff, but when he glanced back, Carlton had already wandered off. Jason bit his lip and rocked on his heels, feeling foolish. After a moment, he went back to the drawings on the wall. There were too many drawings to peruse each one in turn, but Jason suspected he would not need to. As they had the night before, the drawings would come to him. They wanted to be found. All Jason had to do was look. The drawings in the arcade gave up nothing. They were just children's grubby art, faded with age. He went back out into the dining room, still hugging the walls and scanning them, hunting for something that was more than crayon.
"What are you up to, Jason?"
Lamar was suddenly behind him. Jason turned around and studied him for a moment, considering. He liked Lamar, even if his friendliness could be traced easily to his interest in Marla. Lamar had bent down so his head was almost level with Jason's, and Jason leaned toward him and whispered,
"The drawings are moving."
Lamar drew back, and for a moment a look of real alarm crossed his face, but it was fleeting. Jason bit his lip, waiting, and Lamar grinned at him, then reached out to pat him on the head.
"Okay, Jason, we'll get you the help you need," he said heartily, and Jason laughed and slapped Lamar's hand away.
"Shut up, seriously,"
Jason said with a hint of sheepishness, and Lamar patted his head again and headed off. As soon as Lamar was a few feet away, Jason rolled his eyes.
"What do you think I am, your pet?"
He gave his hair a violent tussle as if he could shake loose whatever Lamar had done to him, then went back to the wall, concentrating. He had made his way all along one wall and was turning the corner when it happened. A flicker, just out of the corner of his eye, almost a shimmering. He stopped.
Which one was it?
He scanned the drawings again, going up and down the wall carefully, around the place he thought he had seen movement, but there was nothing. He started over, stopping to look at each crayon scribble, and then it happened again. He seized on it this time, his eye finding the drawing just as the shimmer of movement stopped, and just as he did, he saw another, so brief he would have ignored it, just a trick of the light, had he not been watching for it. It was above the first and maybe 2 feet to the left. His eyes darted back and forth, trying to see both at once. Suddenly, there was a third movement in a drawing between the two, this one more noticeable. This time, he almost saw the drawing shift before it was still again. Sitting back on his heels, Jason looked at the three drawings, each in turn. The crayon was black, and they all looked like they had been drawn by the same kid, all with two figures in the foreground, a child and a rabbit. Jason glanced around the room. His sister and the others still seemed to be engaged by the stage. Lamar had gone back to join them. Jason pulled the drawing he had found the night before from his pocket. He smoothed it out, pressing it to the surface of the floor. Then, slowly, he peeled its linty tape out flat and stuck the paper to the wall just at his eye level. He stared at the wall, waiting. Nothing happened. Jason frowned. He had been so certain these would tell him something, but they were just drawings. The child and the bunny stood in the middle of the paper, in one close together, in another far apart. But there was nothing there that could be called a story. Oh well. He started to look over at the others again, and the highest one began to move. This time he saw the shift. The crayon lines twisted and slid on the page, moving of their own accord, too fast to follow. When the first stopped moving, another started. They continued one after the other until the last, the one he had just put back, was finished. Jason watched, eyes wide, his heart pounding, but by the time he realized what was happening, it was over. The figures were fixed in place, and now they did tell a story. In the first, a child was sitting alone. In the second, Bonnie appeared behind the child. In the next, Bonnie had snatched the child, lifting it off the ground. In the last, the child was screaming. His eyes wide and his heart racing, Jason stepped back. He was transfixed. His body suddenly felt leaden, too heavy to run. A sound arose, like wind rustling the pages on the wall, though they hung motionless before him. The sound rushed and grew, louder and louder until wind gave way to screaming. Jason clapped his hands over his ears as pages began to drop from the walls, landing with loud crashes, as if they were made of something far heavier than paper. As he watched, the fallen pages turned a dark red, soaking through with color as they touched the floor. Jason turned to run, but his path was blocked as pages tumbled from the ceiling in a torrent. One landed on his shoulder, another on his back, and then another, and they clung to him, wrapping around him as if they would suffocate him. Jason felt his legs buckle under the weight, dropping at last to one knee. As he braced himself under the storm of paper, the room began to shake violently. Jason gritted his teeth, trapped. And suddenly, it was over. The red-soaked papers were gone. There was nothing on his back. And Marla had him by the shoulder and was staring at him, wide-eyed.
"Jason, what on earth is wrong with you?"
Jason scrambled to his feet, brushing himself off as if he were covered with invisible insects.
"The pictures were falling on me," he said urgently, still panicked, but as he looked back at the wall, he realized that the room was silent and still.
A single picture had fallen from its place. Marla looked down at it, then back to her brother, and shook her head. She leaned close and hissed into his ear,
"You embarrass me."
She let loose her grip after a moment, her face almost blank, and walked away. Jason stumbled as he got to his feet, but followed as quickly as he could, keeping his eyes trained on the walls as they went. In the control room, Dave had his hands on the buttons, his fingers wandering lightly over them without pressing anything. The movement looked careless, instinctual, like a habit. Charlie leaned close to John.
"He's been here before," she whispered. "Look at the way he touches the controls."
"Maybe he's just good with computers," John offered, not sounding convinced.
"Can you make them dance again?" Jessica asked.
Dave barely seemed to acknowledge the question. His mouth hung slightly open, and he seemed to be staring at something none of them could see. In the bright lights, they could all see that his uniform was grubby and torn in places, his face poorly shaven, and his eyes a little unfocused. He looked less like a guard than a vagrant, and he looked at them all as if he had wandered in ages ago and they were the newcomers. It took him a moment to register the question.
"Sure, let's see what we can do," he said.
He smiled at her, his mouth askew. His eyes were a little too intent on her face, holding her gaze just a little too long. Jessica swallowed, seized with an instinctive revulsion, but she smiled back politely.
"All right," Dave said. "I've been here a few times before. I think I can work some magic."
Charlie and John exchanged glances.
"You've been here before?" John said in a careful, even tone,
but Dave ignored him, or did not hear. There was a keypad to the far left of the control board that no one had touched yet, as it did not appear to be connected to anything. Now Dave reached for it and began to press the buttons quickly, as if he had done it 100 times before. He gave Jessica a conspiratorial glance.
For special occasions, you can request a dance.
He smiled at her again with that crooked intensity.
Great,
Jessica said, breathing a sigh of relief. Anything to get out of such forced proximity to this man. She looked at Lamar.
I'm going to go look. Will you take over?
Yeah, sure, he said, scooting forward to fill the vacancy as Jessica and Dave made their way out to the show area.
On stage, the lights were flashing in patterns, accompanying music that no longer played, and Bonnie's mouth was moving as though in song. His eyelids closed for long blinks, then opened again with loud clicks, his glass eyes moving from side to side. One large blue hand rose and fell, strumming exaggeratedly on the red guitar whose strings had long since gone missing.
Lamar, how much of this are you doing?
Carlton said, suitably impressed.
Not much, Lamar called back. Most of it seemed pre-programmed.
Bonnie turned to them, and Jessica startled as he seemed to look right at her. But he turned away just as quickly to face the rows of empty seats, lifting his head to sing.
It's strange seeing them like this, Jessica said, taking a step back to get a better view.
Bonnie's foot tapped along in rhythm, and his mouth opened and closed with song. There was no voice. There was no music. There was only a strange humming coming from the speakers, and an orchestra of mechanical snaps and squeaks. Bonnie sped up, strumming and tapping faster. His eyes suddenly seemed out of sync, looking left while the head went right, then rolling back into his head. Dave approached the stage with deliberate steps.
Nervous little fella, aren't you?
He smiled, seemingly unbothered as the rabbit moved faster and faster.
Hey, Lamar, can you take it down a notch? Jessica called.
Bonnie's arms began convulsing violently, his mouth open but stuttering, his eyes throwing their gaze in seemingly random directions.
Lamar, something's wrong,
Jessica cried. Bonnie's foot jerked upward with a sound like a gunshot, yanking free the bolt that anchored him to the stage.
Lamar!
Carlton climbed onto the stage and hurried to Bonnie, trying to search the rabbit for an off button as he ducked its erratic swings.
Carlton, get down, you idiot!
Jessica ran to the stage. Bonnie was moving too fast, out of control as if his program had hit a glitch. He was no longer following the dance sequence they all remembered so well. He began to convulse and thrash. Carlton scrambled back, trying to get away, but Bonnie's arm broke away from the guitar, swinging out and hitting Carlton across the chest, knocking him off the stage. He landed on his back and stayed down, gasping for breath.
Lamar!
Jessica shouted.
Lamar, turn it off!
I don't know how!
He yelled back. Jessica knelt down beside Carlton, looking helplessly at him. She tapped his shoulder insistently.
Carlton, are you okay? Carlton, look at me.
Carlton gave a small laugh that sounded more like a cough, then grabbed her hand and pulled himself up to sit.
It's okay, he said. Just got the wind knocked out of me.
Jessica still looked worried.
I just need a minute,
he assured her, the words still coming in little wheezes. In the control room, Lamar pressed button after button frantically, but on the screens he could still see Bonnie moving wildly and at random, not responding to anything he did. Charlie rushed in, pushing him out of the way, but it took her only seconds to see that the buttons were powerless. She locked eyes with Lamar for a moment.
We aren't in control, she thought.
As one, they rushed from the control room to help the others. Jessica screamed, a short, high-pitched sound, and Marla and John ran to her, Charlie and Lamar arriving seconds later. All the animals were moving now in that same fitful way, cycling through their programmed movements at random with a desperate, panicked air. The lights began to pulse,